Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and I want to tell you about a great company, wherecanibuystamps.info. You know, as a professional podcaster, I'm always sitting around with things to mail, and I say to myself, where can I buy stamps? You know, I'm sending demo tapes to radio stations to see if they'll put me on their station, and I don't have stamps, so I need a site that can tell me where I can buy them. Oh, here's another story about stamps. I used to get birthday cards from my grandma back in the 80s, and I would always look at the envelopes and say, geez, where did grandma get these stamps? Well, if I had wherecanibuystamps.info, I could have known up to 7 places where she might have bought them.
1 penny, 2 penny, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies make a
nickel.
Hi, everyone. Do you like ads? Of course you don't. They're stupid. And even though School Sucks is a project that requires a lot of time and money, we're working hard to keep the show ad-free. You can help us by going to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and become a monthly subscriber. You'll get access to hundreds of hours of additional content, and it really, really helps the show. If enough people do it, it's like having sponsors. Except you don't have to sit there and listen to me pretend to care about a ridiculous company like wherecanibuystamps.com. Are you kidding?
Let's go faster!
Thank you.
1 penny, 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies, make a
nickel.
6 pennies, 7 pennies, 8 pennies, 9 pennies, 10 pennies, make a
dime.
2 dimes and a nickel make a
quarter.
Tonight, condemned as witches.
I can't imagine anything worse than being accused of something you didn't do when you'd never be able to prove your innocence.
But if the Salem trials were today, could modern drug testing provide the evidence to acquit?
This could be associated with LSD.
An autopsy on this ancient mummy may help unravel the witch's curse.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the School Sucks Live show for May 9th, 2013. I'm Brett, and in the studio with me tonight is Osborne. How are you doing, Osborne?
I'm well, sir. Glad to be here again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, before the show tonight, I did something that was a real achievement for me as a caster, a professional caster, and that is interviewing a podcasting legend, Dan Carlin, who is the host of Common Sense, which is kind of a political and current event show, and what he is probably best known for and has gotten him on other shows like Joe Rogan and Free Domain Radio is his Hardcore History. Have you ever listened?
You know, I don't think I have.
No?
I hear people talk about him all the time.
He's
sure.
Very, very likable. Really super nice guy. I wanted to talk to him, you know, just about his path as a podcaster and a little bit about his process as well. But we actually got into some debate eventually. It was an interesting conversation. And Dan comes from a different point of view entirely. He definitely describes himself as a civil libertarian, but he is very much still, I think, holding out for some kind of hope for political solutions to the problems that we face as a people. And the conversation, it went so many different places so fast. It was hard to keep track of everything. And I really wanted to talk to him about the Nazis and focus more on history. But somehow, like around the 50-minute mark, we transitioned to politics. And I didn't want to scare him away. I think when people hear the show, they'll say, why didn't you say anything when he said this? And, you know, I just wanted him to be heard. He's definitely a big influence on me. I really liked his style early on. Yeah, and I started listening to him like 5 or 6 years ago. The reason I mentioned the Dan Carlin conversation, I would like to talk more about history on the show. Remember we did that great Thanksgiving show?
I love that Thanksgiving show.
I really like, I have a hard time like preparing, and I asked Dan about this, like how do you prepare a narrative like that? And I would think there's probably a lot of editing, a lot of stopping, a lot of resetting. And in preparation for the show, I was listening to the 3-part series that I did on the Nazis, the American Way.
Mm, right.
That was like the best work I've done.
I agree. I think.
And one of the things that I think I did in that series that I do question a little bit is trying to explain what happens in history too much from what is often referred to as the trends and forces theory of history, right? So an example of a trends and forces historian or historical commentary would be Marx, right? Where he says everything is this economic determinism And you can kind of know what people are going to do because this is the chain of events and everything is very predictable. And there's also this great man theory of history, which is very mystical. Like sometimes this great man just appears and changes the whole direction, which obviously can't exist as its own theory because there's other factors involved in any event or chain of events. And, Dan and I agree that it's pretty much a synthesis of those things. So what happened in Germany, like if you remember how we learned history in public school, they say World War One happened because some guy shot a guy.
Right.
And then World War II happened because Hitler.
Right.
And they're disconnected events. We've talked about that before. But the way I came to understand it is that Germany, because of its history, because of the philosophy and the political ideology, was really like a gasoline-soaked house. And those things that happened in the first half of the 20th century were just like matches being thrown at it, and eventually it went up. But those matches could be important. And how much, if those matches aren't there, how much does that change? Can Germany just sit there as a gasoline-soaked house and eventually dry? Sorry, I know this is a little heavy with metaphor, but, the accidents of history, those little wild cards, how important are those things? I'm interested to hear people's thoughts. I was listening to one of his shows where it's called History Under the Influence. We didn't get to talk about it, but he says, during World War II, there's a very good chance that Churchill and Stalin were shit-faced. And Hitler was high on amphetamines.
Isn't it common knowledge that Churchill was shit-faced?
I'd say it's pretty common knowledge that Churchill was a drunk, that he would stay up all night drinking. And then I don't understand. I mean, my relationship with drinking was a little different than other people's, but I don't understand how you drink continuously for and stay awake.
Oh,
without,
I do.
without any breaks.
Right.
Yeah. I would always pass out and that kind of thing, or just get too drunk to be functional. But do you think? That's an interesting question. One of the things that he brings up in the show is that when Germany invaded the Soviet Union, Stalin disappeared for 3 days. Hmm. And they think he went – there's a theory that he went on a bender, right? So drinking, obviously, we all know what it does to inhibition, but it also makes people more emotional, and more aggressive. And it's interesting to think that these people who held all this power, and I think it really speaks to how dangerous power is, that power can be consolidated in such a way so the person who's holding it could just be all shitty drunk. He also talks about JFK in the show, and he's talking about how I didn't know that JFK was in really poor health and had all kinds of pains and was very heavily medicated.
Oh, I didn't
and
know that.
Went to a doctor that the doctors in Hollywood called, or the actors who also went to see this doctor called this doctor Dr. Feelgood. Because he made some kind of concoction that he injected into people.
Oh.
And JFK was getting these injections. And you think about all of that happening during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh.
And JFK is on all these pills. And
do you think that's why he went all anti-war and stuff?
Because he
started feeling good from medications?
Well,
I mean, I'm not an expert on this stuff or anything, but my cursory understanding is that's why they killed him, right? Because he was wanting to de-escalate.
There was some escalation, I think, in Southeast Asia that he was initially responsible for, and then it seemed like he changed his mind and started going in the other direction. Mm-hmm. There's I think part of the conspiracy, or part of the thing that makes the conspiracy so intriguing, is there's so many reasons why they might have killed him. And it would be hard to say, if somebody killed Thomas Jefferson, there might be a narrower list of suspects. But obviously, his government has grown and more people have a stake in what government is and what government does. The suspect pool grows larger and larger. And JFK also pissed a lot of people off. So it was hard to tell who would have been, mad enough to do that and why. Was it the mafia? Was it the Cubans? Was it the CIA? Was it someone inside the military industrial complex? Or as Oliver Stone kind of suggests in his film, was it some weird combination of many of those things or all of those things? So the typical theory is that JFK was really butting heads with the CIA and was talking about splitting up the CIA, that it was too dangerous an organization. And the CIA obviously had access to, they had mob connections, they had Cuban connections, and easily could have found somebody to actually do that work. and somebody to pin it on. So I think the CIA is the most realistic suspect in that of all the ones that are named. But, you know, I saw this really good movie once called Evidence of Revision. It was about 6 hours. It dealt with the Kennedy, both Kennedy assassinations and Martin Luther King assassination. And it shows you the real footage, the news footage from the time, like as these stories are breaking. And now some of this could be written off as like, well, nobody has the real story initially. But it uses kind of like those firsthand reports to show you how much the story of what happened has changed. Mm-hmm. And I think it even goes and covers like Jim Jones in Jonestown. And it really implicates Lyndon Johnson as somebody who really wanted Kennedy dead. So you have central bankers, Lyndon Johnson, the mafia, the CIA, and the Cubans. Mm. And five good groups of suspects.
There's a big gun convention that goes on in Kentucky, I think, every year. And this is a big deal. Like dozens of thousands of people show up to this thing. Mm-hmm. I guess they have this contest every year where they replicate the JFK shooting. And they set it up just like the official story says that it happens.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, many $1,000 prize offered to anyone who can make the shot. And evidently no one's ever been able to do it.
The shot, the magic bullet.
Yeah.
Well, they tried to, I think it was Peter Jennings. They did a special on ABC, and I want to say this was right before September 11th. I remember seeing it. I'm not saying anything. I'm not getting conspiratorial. Where the mission of this program was to dismiss the idea that there was any kind of intergovernmental conspiracy involving the JFK shooting. And they explain it by just saying, well, the bullet seems magical because the positions of the two people who got shot with it were different, right? So what conspiracy theorists always tried to do was they tried to put Kennedy and Connolly in the car together, like sitting exactly in the same position and at the same height. Kennedy and his wife were sitting in the back seat of this limousine, and Connolly was in front of him in a jump seat that was offset and lower. And he was also turned while JFK was facing straight ahead. So it's possible that that could have been one bullet. But the thing where the bullet hits him and his head goes back clearly and to the left, as Kevin Costner pointed out in JFK, back into the left, it's hard to believe that that's a shot that came from behind. And I remember watching this Peter Jennings special, and I remember him saying, sometimes experts say, sometimes when you get shot from the, you know, from the back, your body goes forward. And sometimes when you get shot from the back, your body goes backwards.
Yes. I have read about that before. Like you would think that if you get like shot in the back of your head, that you would get propelled forward, but that's not oftentimes what happens. That like the explosion of the bullet coming out the front of your head pushes it back or something like that.
But you see, it does look like an exit wound, right? That when
I
is
don't know.
Have you seen it?
I've seen it, but I can't recall it.
It's pretty grim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't often watch videos of people getting shot.
Right. Yeah. It's hard to escape that one. Someone said he had an exit wound in the back of his head, James claims. Somebody else asked, does the movie touch on the Malcolm X assassination? No, I think it concludes with, actually, I don't know. If it does, I don't remember. It really dealt with JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King. And the whole documentary is about 6 hours. I've never found it in a better version on YouTube than like 240 resolution. But it's, I mean, if you can invest the time, it's worth a watch. Somebody else says, do you remember the parody of the JFK magic bullet scene in a Seinfeld episode with Keith Hernandez? Sure do. There's also a movie called JFK 2. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
All right. The theory for this, and then we'll get back to like a more grounded and serious historical discussion. JFK 2, one of my favorite movies. Okay. The guy says that he bases the whole story, right, his whole theory around the fact that there's supposedly a letter. It either goes to Hoover at the FBI or some central figure at the CIA around the time of the Kennedy assassination, mentioning a person who works for the CIA named George Bush. Now, eventually, we know that George Bush does become the head of the CIA under Gerald Ford. But this claims that he was actually involved in the CIA much longer, or at least had some kind of association. In the letter, he's called George Bush of the CIA. The documentarian goes from there to claim that it was George Bush who killed.
I've definitely heard this before.
I think I might have told this story on the show.
Well, I know I've heard it was a Lou Rockwell podcast where he interviewed someone who wrote a book detailing much of the shadiness of that Bush family.
Yeah.
And evidently, like, they've got some serious things going on.
Was it Greg Palast?
I can't remember who
Bush
it was.
Family Fortunes?
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, so it talks about Prescott Bush and...
Yeah, I am.
Oh, yeah,
he seemed pretty convinced that the Bushes somehow were involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, there was Prescott Bush was indicted in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemies Act.
Right.
You can see the document. He was involved in, I forget the names of the banks, Merchants Bank, Union Banking, Brown Brothers Harriman. Gosh, I need to commit that stuff to memory. I do know it. It's actually talked about, I believe, in the third episode of that American Way series. Yes. So interesting that you would bring that up, because the position of the person who made this documentary is that because George Bush Sr. killed JFK Sr., George Bush Jr. killed JFK Jr.
Oh.
As a rite of passage.
Oh, I never heard that one. Very interesting.
I think this film is a parody. Okay. I don't think this is a serious documentary. It can't be. I would be very surprised if somebody really believed that. Mm. But what if it was true? How about that? That's how you get to be president. You have to kill. If your name is Bush, you have to kill a Kennedy to become president. Oh,
it wouldn't be the weirdest thing I've ever heard of.
Right. Now, there's another Bush that's going to get very popular because he's part Hispanic.
Who is that?
His name is George P. Bush, and he's the product of a Bush and a Hispanic, a Mexican, and he is entering into politics.
Now, and the George W. Bush was very well supported by Latinos.
Really?
So I imagine that this one is going to be, like, even better.
Why was George Bush supported by Latinos? Because of Texas?
I just assume because he was from Texas. I don't know. Yeah. Evidently, they really liked him there.
He also spoke Spanish a little bit.
Taco.
¿Dónde está? Then he would say something else that a Spanish-speaking person would know.
Strategery.
Anyway, how did we go to such a ridiculous place
from such a promising topic?
Oh, yeah. So
history. We were going to talk about this other history thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you sound enthusiastic. So let me get back on track.
Oh, my God. More history.
So this history under the influence of, like, which covers Napoleon. I think the further back in time you go, the drunker and more trippin' these people are probably going to be on more frequently.
It seems to be frowned upon today.
Yeah.
For legislators to be inebriated, at least publicly.
Yeah. So there was also somebody wrote a book that actually had a lot of evidence in it that Alexander the Great had a pretty serious drinking problem, which would explain a lot. But it cites these these drinking parties that they had. Like, he would have a schedule, like an itinerary for what he was going to do every day. And, like, several hours of a day was just drinking parties. And he died very young.
Sounds like my old days, yeah.
Of kind of a sudden an illness that came on quick and got very severe, which is certainly possible from binge drinking. So that it's interesting. I guess the general point that I'm trying to make is how these little things that are often overlooked can really, really change how things play out. And what I was worried that I had done in the past is attribute what has happened to, like, the grander scheme of philosophy or underlying or political ideologies that really steer entire cultures. And what we talked about in that series is that if it wasn't Hitler, no, it was me, you, and Dale, actually. We talked about this one night. If it wasn't Hitler, it would have been somebody else. So there's this great philosophical, like, moral question: would you go and you kill Hitler if he was a baby?
Right.
Right. I don't know if it would matter, and I'm not advocating killing babies, but it would be interesting to see what would change.
There's a great NoFX song called "The Man I Killed." It's a first-person confessional of assassinating a political figure, and at the end, they discover that it didn't do any good because the man who replaced him actually plan the whole scenario.
Well, I don't think, yeah, and I don't think it would be terribly surprising to people like us who obviously see strong parallels between government and organized crime, where in organized crime, they're just waiting to bump people off, not to change things, but to put somebody else into that place, right?
Yeah, so it's a succession plan.
Yeah, like very little about the trajectory or the future or the direction of the Gambino crime family changed when, you know, they killed Paul Castellano and John Gotti took his place. In fact, some would say that it got worse. So the idea that if you just take these people out, it seems like if the philosophical trends, I mean, in Germany, the roots were deep, 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 like back to the Holy Roman Empire, where the people had been primed for centuries to believe men who came along and claimed to be gods because they didn't really have any enlightenment there, or at least it was a watered down enlightenment compared to what they had in Western Europe. And without that enlightenment, because of the German idealism to a certain extent, but also because the Holy Roman Empire was controlling Central and Eastern Europe, we see what becomes of that in the 20th century. So not that Great Britain or France are these heroic states, but we certainly don't see what happened there happening in Germany or Russia. Those places go nuts under Hitler and Stalin. So it's interesting. It's interesting. If someone says, if you went back in time and killed baby Hitler, he would only die in that particular timeline and universe. According to some theories, at least. Thank you for setting us straight on that. We will cross it off the to-do list. Yeah, Dan talks a lot about having the time, like the theoretical, what would you do if you had a time machine question. And I think he said in that show, I would go back and I would give Hitler a drug test.
Yeah.
I'd want to see what he was on. Hitler.
Yeah, just think about where we're at today and pick a politician and just eliminate him from reality. Like, is anything ever going to be different because of that? No.
But that's the thing that we know. I mean, the whole point of that series was that what happened in Nazi Germany is happening again here. But I think more specifically, we see these ominous parallels to fascism happening again here. And what Dan said in the show is it's not going to look like it did in Nazi Germany, but there are a lot of places where, you know, if you took a lot of scenes from America and you just like applied like a grain effect to it and turned it to black and white, in some cases you might not know the difference. But I think he's still right that there can only be one Holocaust in the enlightened world. Now, I understand these things have happened in Africa, but it's not like I really don't think that Americans now or forever. Oh, gosh, I don't know. It's hard to generalize like that, because I think there's some people, if you said we're taking Alex Jones and all his fans, we're putting him on a train and we're sending him to a re-education camp, there would have to be people who would be happy about that. Do you agree?
Yeah. Or, I mean, just think about a few years ago. How many people would say something like, well, we just need to get rid of all the Muslims?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure there's still people like that. But I remember sitting in a seminar where a Nobel Prize-winning economist said exactly that.
How did he say it? What was the context?
He said, we should kill all the Muslims.
What was the speech about?
I don't even remember. That was the only part that really stuck in my head. Like, oh, man, this is not someone I want to hang out with.
Now, did he do it in kind of a trolling? Like, I would do it in a trolling way where I build up the momentum of the crowd, you know, like politicians do. They build that crescendo that leads to applause. And then right when everyone was cheering for what I just said, I'd say, kill the Muslims. Yeah. It wasn't anything like that. It was actually part of the content of his speech.
I think it was like as an aside, because this was shortly after 9/11.
And you had this tea party, too, that you got all pissed off at. We talked about this before because people were being racists.
Yeah. Possibly. Actually, there wasn't a whole lot of racism. It was more a homophobia.
The same idea.
I don't even know if you call it homophobia. It was just like anti-homo.
Didn't someone say Ohio was great because we killed all the Indians?
Yes, there was that.
That would be frustrating to be the organizer of an event where that is uttered.
Yes, thank you for reminding me.
So
high point of my Liberty career.
But when you think about Hitler was so freaking crazy. Like, if you just kind of think generally about what he did. He divides his country in every way possible. he economically decapitates it pretty much by going after the Jews. Or eventually that would have been and I understand there was some fake kind of Keynesian economic recovery in the 30s because of what Hitler did. He created the illusion of an economic recovery. But he divides his society. So he splits everything up and causes all of this friction internally. And then he says, okay, we're going out to fight wars in both directions against huge powers. So he goes east to Russia and west to France. That is insane. And anybody who was even relatively not batshit crazy in his military, like any of his advisors, must have been, there must have been people who were absolutely terrified of what he was doing.
Sure.
Yeah. I imagine that scene from Downfall that people use to make like videos on YouTube where Hitler reacts to stuff. I imagine things really looking and feeling quite like that.
Yeah. Wonder, are there stories of people who just like disappeared? Like, I'm not doing this. I'm out. And you never hear about them?
Like,
because they didn't make it into history?
Like they weren't going to go along?
Yeah.
From what kind of event?
Military people.
Right? No, like, I think
you want me to do what? No.
I think history is a lot like politics today. I remember one time my dad said to me, the most vocal people on either side of the political spectrum, the ones you hear from the most are always the dumbest and the craziest, you know? And it's pretty true. And I think I might have talked about this on the show before, but there's this essay question that I always use with the SAT kids to kind of just maybe inject a little bit of my ideas into that curriculum, where the question is conscience a more powerful motivator than money, fame, and power? And then I always ask them, I say, okay, think of some people who were motivated by their conscience, who you can clearly say had no other agenda aside from their sense of what's right and what's wrong. Can you think of anybody? Even without like really digging into people, like people on the surface who were just more motivated by seemingly wanting to make the world a better place, even if it meant some great personal cost to them.
I'm just trying to think of people that you probably hear brought up.
Yeah, I have a list.
Abraham Lincoln, is that going to be at the top of the list?
No, somebody did say Abraham Lincoln once. And the way I answer that, people have said Lincoln, people have said Jefferson. Somebody said Obama, and then another kid in the class laughed at him once. But I always use that question because I do like to put my finger on the pulse of, you know, what high school kids think of that.
You like putting your fingers on high school kids?
On the pulse of what they think about that. Yes. I just want to be a special. You never know when somebody can say we become famous. This becomes hugely successful. They go in and they cut that clip where you say you like putting your fingers on high school kids. And then they go to a later point in the show
where you say, I love it.
Yeah. Oh, we just gave them another opportunity to do
right.
it.
Right.
Where I was even more enthusiastic. We got to be careful. Hopefully that won't happen. So, yeah, but I'm always interested in what they're going to say and what they're who do they think are virtuous people. So, I am pleasantly surprised to hear how seldom those names are mentioned, how seldom they say Lincoln. But if they do, and it does happen, maybe like once a class somebody will throw out a political George Washington, somebody like that. Is it you really think we could be sure that a person in politics was motivated by conscience more than power? And they always kind of retreat from that and say, no, yeah. Like, since you put it that way, of course not. They would be motivated by power. Because then when we start entering names into this that, you know, better fit what we're talking about, the idea of the primary motivator is a sense of what's right and wrong, that political figure stands out as kind of the odd man because the names they usually say, first I ask the question and no one says anything. Usually they kind of like, oh, that's a tough question. Mm-hmm. Who do you think the first person is? They say non-political.
Mother Teresa.
She is on the list.
Yeah.
This is my list of five.
Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay. So now we're down to three. Two of the five are crossed off. Who else? Clearly motivated by conscience. Go now.
Clearly.
So you're in two places that are good to think about. One is the civil rights or you know, and the other is
religion.
Eastern Asia.
Eastern Asia. Oh.
Or Central Asia, I guess. No, that's Western Asia. I'm sorry.
Western Asia. The Jesus.
Jesus is okay. Often on the list.
Muhammad.
A guy almost named Muhammad. A name like Muhammad.
Malcolm X. Gandhi.
All right, okay. So...
Well, that was a political figure, though.
Not primarily, I don't think.
Right.
It wasn't like a head of state, a legitimate head of state, like a king or a president or something.
All right.
So one more is Rosa Parks.
Oh.
So those are that's the standard five, and I will usually write that list down and cross them off as kids name them. I mean, all of those people have more nuances to them. Martin Luther King was certainly a far from perfect person. There's a lot of criticisms of Gandhi and his support of
Let's talk about Martin Luther King Jr. I've never heard any stories about, I mean, I've certainly heard his philandering and whatnot stories, but that's not really related to his activism. Like, I've never really heard anything that his activism was the result of some nefarious purpose.
He was more of a socialist. And sometimes you have to take the bad with the good of people, the small bads with the good of people. I mean, I don't know if he would have been a good president. Not that anyone's a good president, but I mean, the adultery, and he had some pretty far left political views. But I mean, I think that he is somebody who, it's safe to say about any person who rose to that kind of position of prominence, that he was. Certainly a sense of right and wrong was very important to guide him. Rosa Parks, that's a courageous story of somebody who was willing to take risks for change. Mother Teresa was crazy.
Yeah.
She thought voices were telling her to do that stuff, so it's hard to say she was motivated by conscience. It's not a bad list. I mean, the worst list, and Jesus, I don't know. I mean, from what the books say, he was a good guy. They were listing him in the chat, and they had pretty much the same list from what I see. How did we get to there?
You're talking about history.
Oh, come on, man. Someone in the chat, tell me how I got off on that conscience question.
People getting drunk, your conscience question from your SAT class.
But why did I bring that up? Why did I go to the point where I said, I always ask this question? This is very important to the overall narrative of this show. We need to come up with that connection. Can somebody in the chat who has been paying attention to what I've been saying tell me the transition that I'm looking for? I'm going to take a deep breath, and we're going to reset, and we're going to figure out how this works. You said, were there ever any people who just disappeared?
Oh, all right. That's right.
Okay. All right. Here we go, everyone. We're back on track, and I understand why everything has happened now and the chain of events that has brought us to this place. Osborne asked the question, are there people that we just don't hear about because they don't go along and they disappear? So we do hear, obviously, about the people who don't go along in such a notable way, like Operation Valkyrie, right? The plot to kill Hitler. One of the plots. There were many plots to kill Hitler, some lesser known than others. But the reason why I brought up that question of what is a more powerful motivator of human beings, money, fame, or power, or conscience, on the other hand, so money, fame, and power all together, and then the opposite or the other position would be conscience. Well, most people who are in the history books were fucking nuts.
Oh, right.
And drunk on power, as somebody in the chat pointed out, thank you, and that's the reason why they made history. So one of the reasons why I think we have, and that was why I brought up the thing about what my dad said about politics. It's always the lousiest, craziest people that are making the most noise or that are getting themselves on. It's always Lindsey Graham and Bloomberg that are getting on television, the most power-drunken assholes. Those are the people who made history. Those are the people that the narrative of history relies upon. And what that has given us, I think, is a totally skewed and darker opinion or understanding for the most part of what human beings are. Because most people probably were motivated more by conscience, whether it was for Christian reasons or philosophical reasons. But many of them are in unmarked graves, and their names are never mentioned in the history books. So history is about the power hungry and the killers and the insane. And those are the people who personalized the human story, which is really unfortunate. And I think just like going and sitting, like learning history is very much like watching the news every night and saying the world is a screwed up place. Well, it's only telling you about the worst things that happen because it's newsworthy. And history, I think, is almost the same way. History is a story of crazy inbred assholes prior to, definitely prior to the year 1800. And obviously more people have come into it, and other historians who set out to tell stories from different points of view. So like most history is told from the great man theory of history, right? Mm-hmm. First there was Alexander the Great, and then there was Julius Caesar, and it's just punctuated. These periods are divided by these eras in which these great men lived. And then maybe somebody, I'm sure other people might have tried this, but somebody like Howard Zinn comes along and says, no, history is about ordinary people. It's about people's movements. It's about labor unions. It's about, you know, the civil rights. It's minorities. He tells this completely different story that in many cases villainizes, and appropriately so, the people who history has always worshipped.
Can you imagine watching Game of Thrones if there were no bastard children, and if everybody was just nice to each other,
I think
there wouldn't be anything to watch.
So what does that say about history?
People working in the fields, like, oh man, here's some new potatoes.
Do you think that's why people, like, really in the last couple decades are so fascinated by the Nazis? Because they're just such an easy, like, clear cut bad guy. And people don't seem to, if you think about what movies people like James Bond or something like that, or the television, like all these cop shows or like NCIS or whatever, people seem to like in their entertainment very clean, thick lines between good and bad. And people seem to get very offended and uncomfortable when you start to try and tell the human story of somebody like, you know, if they're a liberal Barack Obama or if they're a conservative George Bush, that the bad or the evil starts to bleed across that line into what their conception of good is. So I think one of the reasons that people like the Nazis, and Carlin said that, like, if you put a swastika on a book that you're selling, it's like a guaranteed 10 to 15% increase in sales just because it has a swastika on it. I think people are so enamored by
the
Nazis.
So do we need to put a swastika on the School Sucks website?
That would be bold. So that's a bold – what do people think of that? That's a bold marketing move. I think people are so enamored by the Nazis is because it's such a clean line. It's so clear who the good guys are, people fighting the Nazis. It's us, the Americans. Mm. And there's no question that they're evil. There's no debate about them. So it's a very clear story, right? That seems to have a certain appeal to people. 843, join SSP. You can Skype in School Sucks Live. This is a live show that theoretically, a year ago, we actually launched this show 364 days ago.
Really?
Yeah, on May 10th, 2012. Theoretically, a call-in show where listeners participate. I am always happy to see people talking in the chat. They don't have to be talking about what we're talking about. I am glad that people come and will listen to us talk in the background while they chat with each other. But I'm also, I really like it when I see people writing stuff in the chat. Well, someone says you can't tell a good story without a definite bad guy. The Nazis definitely provide that.
I mean, it seems like these HBO and Showtime shows make their entire agenda out of creating stories where you can't tell good from bad. Or just everyone's bad and there's no good.
Well, yeah, HBO is definitely smarter television, and there's certainly exceptions to that rule. And I know we've maybe mentioned this on the show before, but Martin Scorsese, one of my favorite filmmakers, has made a career out of turning really disgusting, despicable people into the protagonists that you somehow wind up rooting for in his films. So a good example of that on HBO would be The Sopranos.
Right.
Where everyone was like, I love Tony Soprano. Oh, Tony Soprano. Remember that? When that show was on, people were all, they thought they were cool. He was a psychotic killer.
Yeah.
He was a terrible person. And you're blinded by that because he's the protagonist in the show. And I thought the show was so brilliant. And this relates, I think this does relate to what we're talking about. It's so brilliant by the way they sucked you in, how he's kind of like this lovable oaf. And he turned out to be just a ruthless, horrible killer, liar.
Yeah. But like sometimes you can accept a psychotic killer if, you know, they at least are smart about what they do. But the Tony, I mean, he was just kind of a bumbling idiot as well as being an asshole murdering person.
And I wonder if that's another draw for the Nazis. Because if you know a little bit about the Nazis, they were really stupid. Like they were, I mean, they could have been very high IQ people who with good scientists and, well, you know, very like cutting edge scientists and great military strategists, but they believed in silly, silly, silly things.
All kinds of like magic and stuff, right?
Magic and destiny. And, you know, like, I mean, it was their destiny to fight the British and the French. And it was their destiny to have this pure race and to the mystical of capturing biblical treasures and harnessing their powers. Yeah. They're just silly.
I seem to recall the word destiny being used prolifically with regard to the settlement of the American West. As well.
Yes. Hand of God, manifest destiny. The Nazis, like there's easy television, like good guy, like James Bond, right?
Right.
Bond is good. The Russians are bad. If you go back, you know, maybe I think with this new James Bond, they are maybe blurring those lines a little bit. And maybe people want entertainment that's more sophisticated. But if you go back and you look at a lot of the people, what the television being consumed by a lot of the people who are involved in politics or have faith in the political system or political decision makers today, you think about the shows that they were watching, Gunsmoke, you know, The Lone Ranger. And then all of these Westerns, all of these war movies, like that was a very, very popular form of entertainment 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I think, yeah, maybe people, and even with James Bond back in the 60s and the 70s, or shows like that, and maybe people are becoming more sophisticated in what they want in entertainment. They want more of those shades of gray. And the Nazis provide a kind of easy historical adventure, right? I mean, how have the Nazis been portrayed on film?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Very no questions, right? No personal that weird looking guy with the round glasses. Yep. There is no scene where he's searching his soul to, you know, am I doing the right thing? You know, serving the Führer, looking for the Ark of the Covenant. Is this what I should be doing? That doesn't happen. He's just a very cut and dry, as my friend Richard Grove called them one time, cartoon bad guys. But we were talking about the accidents of history, the wild cards of history, the often overlooked aspects. I gave a couple of examples. We were talking about the Nazis and how I have framed that discussion more as something that was entirely dictated by political ideology or forces or trends in philosophy. And it might not be the whole picture, and it might be more useful to synthesize the trends with the sort of great man theory of history, where what would have happened if this person never existed. So I'm kind of backtracking from that position that I held before, that things would have proceeded exactly as they did if Hitler was not in the picture. Hitler is a variable in the history of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s in Central Europe, that without him, I think things could have been dramatically different. So as I said, I'm trying to synthesize better the different ways to look at history. I also asked Dan Carlin about the behind-the-scenes theory of history, right? Are there these darker forces?
Weren't we going to talk about the history of witches?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. Yeah, in a town that I used to live in called Salem, Massachusetts, there might be, and I stress the word might be, more to that story. One event that I've taught about several times in the past in my history courses is a period of colonial America. And these silly, silly people that came here in the 1600s from England called the Puritans. Now, we talked about them a little bit Thanksgiving show.
The Free State Project of the day.
The Free State.
Like all the biggest weirdos who can't get along with their own people disappear, go to a different place.
Right.
All congregate together.
And then gossip about each other?
Yes.
Interesting. And have sex with everyone. Wow. The Puritans came here on the first batch of them. I don't know if you call a group of religious people a batch. I don't know if that's an appropriate word. But they lived here for several generations in the Mass Bay Colony. And by the 1690s, in a very, very religiously repressive culture, things started to get a little crazy. And there's a number of theories as to why this happened. There's also a lot of uncertainty. Like, I really think that the direct cause, there are only theories. It is not definitively known why this happened. But in 1692, there was this group of girls who were somehow associated with this slave woman named Tituba. And she was teaching them some kind of like fortune telling or something. Supposedly, one of the girls started to act very strangely and panicked and claimed to have hallucinations. And then the other girls started making this claim. And the very non-scientific and religiously confused Puritans, also coupled with kind of public panic, believed that this phenomenon was attributable to witchcraft. Supposedly, the slave woman was accused of being some kind of voodoo witch. She apparently confessed to this, which I think is interesting, that she was trying to teach them witchcraft, which could have been a coerced confession.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that the treatment of black women in Salem, Puritan, New England in the 1600s was probably not great.
No.
So they could have coerced a confession out of her.
Or maybe she was just saucy, right? You're like, yeah, I'm a witch. What of it?
That's possible. And I don't know what her fate was. No, she wasn't even killed, because it's the only man who was killed was a guy named Giles Corey. And I think he was black. Oh. And the other people who were either Giles Corey, I believe, was crushed with stones. And I think everyone else was hanged.
Mm.
Crushed with stones.
That sounds not fun.
Why did this happen? People say that, well, it was their religious confusion. It was some kind of public or like jealousy about status in society. And they were trying to...
Is the patriarchy trying to put down the independence of women?
Or the reason why it became such hysteria is because people saw it as an opportunity to like do away with their neighbors that they didn't like.
Oh, right, right. Like they do in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, right?
How do you mean?
Like, oh yeah, that guy over there across the field, he's totally a terrorist. Mm. You better take him away.
Yeah, that's why 6/7 of everyone who was in Guantanamo Bay was ultimately released, because that's actually a really good comparison. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, they were paying per head the Northern Alliance to go and round up al-Qaeda fighters, right? Mm-hmm. So they would just show up back at the base of like, this guy's al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And the guy...
Or this thing that goes on here in the States. What do they call it? Swatting?
Swatting. I'm unfamiliar with that.
No, this is where you make a phone call to the police department and tell them, oh, yeah, my neighbor is running a drug ring over there, and it's crazy, and they're beating women. And then they get a SWAT raid.
And we also have the expression called the witch hunt.
Correct.
In fact, Arthur Miller wrote his play, The Crucible, about this event during, guess what? Period of U.S. history.
The Red Scare.
The Red Scare, which was a witch hunt. So.
Was it? I've heard other versions of that.
What do you mean?
That the government was being infiltrated by communists.
Well, it was both. Yeah. I mean, there was, you can tell since the United States government has swallowed about 9 planks of the Communist Manifesto that it stands to reason that at some point there was some infiltration of the communist ideology. But it also did get carried away by hysteria as well, I think. Something that could play out in many different places for many different reasons, and public fear and hysteria is one of those reasons. A theory was introduced almost 40 years ago at this point that the real cause of what happened in Salem, Massachusetts in the 1690s is that either the girls... Or, in some theories, the entire community was tripping balls.
Yep.
What do you think of that?
I remember when I heard it a number of years, I think I was in high school when I was introduced to this idea. I immediately accepted it because I thought it sounded great. Like, oh, well, that explains everything. And I will just internalize that, and that will be the story I believe.
Well, it does explain a lot, and I mean, it is possible that a panic can lead people to doing a lot of different things. So the idea that all the people were tripping and hallucinating and thinking they were seeing evil spirits and stuff, I think is a little far-fetched. I think it's interesting. It's an interesting theory to look at, but most of the theories relate to the girls And it is claimed that they had something called ergot poisoning. And ergot is fungus that grows on rye, which was a heavily utilized crop in the Mass Bay colony at that time. And there's actually quite a bit of research that has gone into this. This actually came from something called Secrets of the Dead, Part 2, A Witch's Curse.
The symptoms of bewitchment were unsettlingly reminiscent of a bad acid trip. But what connection could there be between the supposedly bewitched residents of Salem and the drug LSD? The answer lay in the strange findings of Swiss neurophysiologist Albert Hofmann. Hofmann had made an extraordinary discovery in 1943 while experimenting with a naturally growing fungus called ergot. Ergot had long been known to contain various potent chemicals, and Hofmann had been trying to harness them for use in medical applications. One day in his lab, he made an extract from the ergot fungus and then accidentally spilled some of it on his hand. The extract must have been absorbed by his skin, and within hours, he began to hallucinate. Colors became intensely vivid. Familiar shapes seemed distorted. He had derived LSD from ergot. A discovery that would catapult him to medical fame and give him a godlike status in the eyes of the hippies. Linda now had the possible connection she was looking for. A natural fungus capable of producing LSD-like hallucinations. She consulted a medical friend to see whether the symptoms of ergot poisoning matched the records from Salem.
I said to my friend, do you have anything that is like a pharmacological encyclopedia? He was a pre-med student, so this wasn't such a bizarre question to ask him. And it was almost as if the description in the pharmacological reference had been taken from the trial records themselves. It was just extraordinary. And that for me was a real eureka moment.
To check out her theory, she decided to put it to the original LSD expert, Albert Hofmann himself.
I wrote him a letter suggesting to him what my hypothesis was. And he wrote me back and he said, well, it sounds plausible. It wasn't a long letter, but certainly he answered the question that I needed him to answer.
Her hunch was a good one, but there was a problem. If ergot was behind the hallucinations, how had the residents of Salem come into contact with the fungus in the first place? One pivotal piece of evidence pointed her in the right direction. She discovered that both people and animals had been affected.
My husband, Benjamin Abbott, had not only been afflicted in his body, as he testifies, but also that strange and unusual things has happened to his cattle, for some have died suddenly and strangely, which we could not tell any natural reason for. Men were sick. Babies were dying. Animals in the community were acting strangely, and people were concerned about the odd behaviors there. So it begins to look like something that could be in the food source, but it's got to be something that both people and animals would be consuming.
In the Salem trial records, Linda found reports not just of hallucinations, but also of other horrific symptoms. A pinpricking sensation, like insects crawling under the skin, and fits so powerful that the sick could barely be held down.
We were conversant with Benjamin Holton for above a week before he died, and he was acted in a very strange manner with most violent fits, and he died a most violent death, and the doctor that was with him said he could not tell what his distemper was.
The passage described a gruesome illness, but more importantly, it illustrated a precedent that had been set long before the settlers arrived in the New World. This was not the first time doctors had been stumped by an unknown illness. And this was not the first time they had made a diagnosis of witchcraft.
So to continue on with this story, the trouble in Salem began during the cold, dark Massachusetts winter, January 1692. Eight young girls began to take ill, beginning with 9-year-old Elizabeth Paris, the daughter of Reverend Samuel Paris, as well as his niece, 11-year-old Abigail Williams. But theirs was a strange sickness. The girls suffered from delirium, violent convulsions, incomprehensible speech, trance-like states, and odd skin sensations. The worried villagers searched desperately for an explanation. Their conclusion? The girls were under a spell, bewitched, and worse yet, by members of their own pious community. And then the finger-pointing began. The first to be accused were Tituba, Paris's Caribbean-born slave, along with Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne, two elderly women considered of ill repute. All three were arrested on February 29th. Ultimately, more than 150 witches were taken into custody. By late September 1692, 20 men and women had been put to death, and 5 more accused had died in jail. None of the executed confessed to witchcraft. Such a confession would have surely spared their lives, but they believed condemned their souls. On October 29th, by order of Massachusetts Governor Sir William Phipps, the Salem witch trials officially ended. When the dust cleared, the townsfolk and the accusers were at a loss to explain their own actions. In the centuries since, scholars and historians have struggled as well to explain the madness that overtook Salem. Was it sexual repression, dietary deficiency, mass hysteria, or could a simple fungus have been to blame? Clues and evidence. When Linda Caporeale began nosing into the Salem witch trials as a college student in the early 1970s, she had no idea that a common grain fungus might be responsible for the terrible events of 1692. But then the pieces began to fall into place. Caporeale, now a behavioral psychologist at New York's Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, soon noticed a link between the strange symptoms reported by Salem accusers, chiefly 8 young women, and the hallucinogenic effects of drugs like LSD. LSD is a derivative of ergot, a fungus that affects rye grain. Ergotism, ergot poisoning, had indeed been implicated in other outbreaks of bizarre behavior, such as the one that afflicted a small French town of Pont-Saint-Esprit in 1951. But could ergot actually have been the culprit? Did it have the means and the opportunity to wreak havoc in Salem? Caporeale's sleuthing, with the help of science, provided the answers. Ergot is caused by the fungus Claviceps purpurea, which affects rye, wheat, and other cereal grains. When first infected, the flowering head of the grain will spew out sweet, yellow-colored mucus, called honeydew, which contains fungal spores that can spread the disease. Eventually, the fungus invades the developing kernels of the grain, taking them over with a network of filaments that turns the grain into a purplish-black sclerotia. Sclerotia can be mistaken for large, discolored grains of rye. Within them are potent chemicals, ergot alkaloids, including lysergic acid, from which LSD is made. The alkaloids affect the central nervous system and cause the contraction of smooth muscle, the muscles that make up the walls of the veins and arteries, as well as the internal organs. Toxicologists now know that eating ergot-contaminated food can lead to a convulsive disorder characterized by violent muscle spasms, vomiting, delusions, hallucinations, crawling sensations on the skin, and a host of other symptoms, all of which, Linda Caporeale noted, are present in the records of the Salem witchcraft trials. Ergot thrives in warm, damp, rainy springs and summers. When Caporeale examined the diaries of the Salem residents, she found that those exact conditions had been present in 1691. Nearly all of the accusers lived in the western section of Salem Village, a region of swampy meadows that would have been prime breeding ground for the fungus. At that time, the rye was a staple grain of Salem. The rye crop consumed in the winter of 1691 and 1692, when the first usual symptoms began to be reported, could easily have been contaminated by large quantities of ergot. The summer of 1692, however, was dry, which could explain the abrupt end of the bewitchments. These and other clues built up into a circumstantial case that Caporeale found impossible to ignore.
Well, folks, the cause of the Salem witch trials has been a source of a tremendous amount of debate, really for centuries now. And from the way I've always approached this story and the way I've thought about history generally, I think it would be, as far as cause is concerned, this event is attributable to the dogma of the Puritans, their ideologies, but also the predictable reaction to a scary event. You know, when you scare people, you can get them to believe anything. And it seems like they were getting each other to believe anything. Fear and emotion hinders the ability to think clearly. And we talked about this one girl who temporarily tried to be a voice of reason. Maybe it was not witchcraft. Maybe none of these people are witches. And when she saw how that went over in the public discussion, she retreated back to the position of finger pointing. And that example right there actually enters into this discussion. Another one of those great destructive forces in history, collectivism, right? Because, and that collectivism is a real trait of any religious fundamentalist sect or community where you have this unanimity. And there's much less of a chance of a debate forming because everyone pretty much is working from the same foundation as far as their thinking, as far as their beliefs are concerned. So it's unlikely that there's going to be a group of people who are willing to question the popular belief. And there's also probably going to be a tremendous deference to authority. If it was the religious leaders who were introducing this idea, well, then that would probably be accepted as fact by the people in that community. So whenever you have this event or chain of events that, you know, creates fear or mass hysteria, I think that conformity and obedience to authority only add to really the predictability of the outcome. But this Urgot thing is interesting. It is definitely one of those wild cards of history. But more wild cards come into the picture when we ask the question, well, how did the Puritans even wind up in New England in the first place? Like, why would British people even think that it would be safe for them to sail to and settle in the New World, starting with Jamestown? Well, not there was one attempt in the late 1580s, early 1590s, to colonize another part of Virginia, but it did not go well. And Jamestown was the first permanent British settlement. But it was just 13 years later that the Puritans came to New England and the Mass Bay colony began. Well, how did it happen? You know, because the story of the 16th century is of Spanish conquest of the New World, starting with Columbus, mostly in the Caribbean. But the Spanish had a claim to this whole scene, this whole hemisphere over here was pretty much considered Spanish territory. Well, it was one weather event that actually changed the course of history. The event is often referred to as the Protestant Wind. In 1588, there is a growing tension, not a new tension between England and Spain, but the tension is increasing over this question of the colonization of the New World. Spain is very powerful. Spain had dominated the 1500s because of their navy. That was the only game in town pretty much back then once it became clear that they were going across the ocean. And to head off the British, the King of Spain, Philip II, decides that he is going to sail the Armada right up the Thames River and invade. And it's also worth mentioning things were very Game of Thronesy back then. This is one of those strange and hard to believe, but not very uncommon royal family quarrels. Philip's sister-in-law is the Queen of England, Elizabeth I, and the British would have been obliterated. The Armada was very powerful. The British were certainly outgunned. And, you know, in the final phase of the attack, a storm comes and pretty much wipes out the Armada. Well, it at least first blows it off course and some ships are sunk. But then as the storm clears and the fleet is all disoriented, the British go out in their smaller, faster clipper ships and are able to pick off even more of the Spanish ships. And whatever is left, which I don't believe was much, winds up retreating. And this is a huge turning point.
in the age of exploration, or now really the age of conquest. And, you know, just to be completely faithful to the timeline here, it wasn't like this opened a door that had been shut before to the British. In fact, Sir Walter Raleigh, who was responsible for some of England's first colonial, like failed colonial attempts in the New World in Virginia and Roanoke later on in the next decade, was already drawing up plans to head that way before this event. So, and that contributed to the tension. The Spanish crown knew that there was a great deal of British interest in this part of the world as well, which is part of the reason for this military action, part of the reason. And that was a weather event that changed the course of history. I mean, maybe things wouldn't look that different today if we swap out the British for another murderous imperial power. But certainly it's interesting to think about how different things could be if that storm had not come. And, you know, we talked in the live show portion of this podcast about those silly Nazis and how frustrating it must have been for, you know, military strategists in the Third Reich or even a military historian to watch Hitler work, the ridiculous things that he tried to do. We've talked plenty about European imperialists and invaders heading west, but one of the first to head east and around the same time, really 100 years later, not long after the witch trials, actually, Charles XII. He was a Swedish king, and he decided to invade Russia in 1709. And that march to Russia in the winter was very, 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 very costly to Charles's troops. Most of them did not make it back. Almost exactly 100 years later, there's another guy, often considered a military genius, but failed in this case to learn from history. Napoleon assembled an army of about 600,000 men. His plan was to march into and take control of Russia in the winter. Now, France has a winter, and they're told Russia has a winter, and they think about what the winter in France is like, and they say, how bad can it be? And they are successful. They make it to Moscow, where they loot and they pillage and they take all these furs to bring back to wives in France. On the way home, it gets so cold that the soldiers wind up unpacking the furs that they were bringing as presents for their wives back to France. And they have to wear women's clothing to prevent freezing to death. It's reported that in one 24-hour period, 50,000 horses died from the cold. Of the 600,000 men who set out on that march to Russia, one quarter of them returned alive. And this failure, this French military failure, is often cited as the turning point for Napoleon, and also the beginning of the emergence of Russia as a formidable power in Europe. 130 years later, another man fails to learn from history, also confused, stricken with mental illness, and possibly heavily medicated. He says, you know when would be a good time to invade Russia? The winter. In September of 1941, the Nazis begin a military campaign, ironically named Operation Typhoon, to take the Soviet Union. There was so much German confidence of the victory in Russia that they actually, the soldiers, packed and marched with their dress uniforms that they would wear when they did, you know, their victory lap in the Russian capital. What they forgot to pack was the thing that saved the lives of maybe 150,000 Frenchmen, fur, winter clothes. And again, Hitler's failure in this Eastern theater of the war is also considered to be a very, very significant turning point in World War II. So if not for mental illness, a failure to learn from history, and bad weather, the outcome of that war might have been quite different. We'd all be speaking Russian right now. All right, have a good day.